From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet civil rights lawyer Morris Dees, the man who bankrupted the United Klans of America. Dees is co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center. For years, he prosecuted individual members of hate groups until he figured out a way to get at the organizations themselves. The National Writers Union will soon vote on affiliating with the United Auto Workers. Coming up, we talk with representatives of each union about what such an affiliation would say about the state of the labor movement today. Henry Kissinger is a perpetual guest analyst on TV news shows, but today he was on CBS This Morning as the guest weatherman. TV critic David Bianculli reviews his performance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A bomb blast at an election rally in southern India has taken the life of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. Gandhi, who was 46, was campaigning for his Congress party in an attempt at a political comeback in the upcoming general elections. Initial reports said that about 15 people were killed in the blast. No one has claimed responsibility for the assassination. Gandhi was a grandson of Prime Minister Nehru and a son of Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, who was murdered by Sikh extremists in 1984. President Bush called Rajiv Gandhi's death a tragic loss. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush said he and Mrs. Bush were close friends with Rajiv Gandhi and his wife.
On a personal basis, I mourn the loss, but when you look at his contribution to international order, and when you think of his decency, it's a tragedy, and that people resort in a democratic country or anywhere to violence of this nature is just appalling.
The president, who appeared tired and drawn as a result of his thyroid condition, added, "I don't know what the world is coming to. It's a sad thing for this young man to have lost his life this way." I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
President Bush insisted today that he is feeling well, despite public concerns that he appears tired and pale. A White House spokesman acknowledged that the president has lost about 12 pounds in recent weeks, but said he's begun to regain some weight in the past few days. The White House physician, Dr. Burton Lee, examined Mr. Bush this morning and said the president's medical team was very happy with his progress. Doctors say it's not uncommon for people undergoing thyroid treatment to look and feel a bit worse before they feel better. The Palestine Liberation Organization announced today that a PLO delegation has been invited for talks in Damascus. It's the first time that the PLO has been welcome in the Syrian capital since the end of the Gulf War. The PLO supported Iraq during its Kuwaiti invasion, while Syria joined the American-led coalition against Saddam Hussein. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Damascus.
The surprise announcement was issued today in Cairo and Tunis. The PLO delegation will be headed by Farouk Kaddoumi, the PLO's foreign minister. The invitation follows a visit by the U.S. Secretary of State James Baker to negotiate terms for an Arab-Israeli peace conference. While Baker made progress in Israel on conditions for Palestinian representation, he left the region with little progress in narrowing the gap between the Syrians and the Israelis. The Syrians want a role for the United Nations. The Israelis say no. There have been suggestions here that Washington might try to organize a peace conference without the Syrians. The meeting with PLO officials may be one way for Syria to send a message to Washington that Syria must be included in any regional negotiations. In Damascus, this is Deborah Amos.
The Dow Industrials gained 13 points today. This is NPR. Ethiopian President Mengistu Haile Mariam resigned today in the face of a rebel advance on Addis Ababa, the country's capital city. Mengistu is believed to have gone into exile, although his exact whereabouts aren't clear. His resignation ends 14 years of Marxist rule over Ethiopia. The Bush administration hailed Mengistu's departure as an opportunity for peace and democracy. Ethiopian state radio said a former defense minister has taken over as acting president, and the government said it would try to arrange a ceasefire with the rebels. Rebel leaders said they were prepared to attend a U.S.-sponsored peace conference next week in London, but they expressed skepticism that the government is really prepared to change. The Chicago Cubs became the second team in Major League Baseball this season to fire its manager. George Hoffman reports.
60-year-old Don Zimmer lost his job this morning in New York as his team prepared to play the Mets. The Cubs were tied for last place with an 18-19 record. They were considered a favorite to win the National League East. Zimmer's Cubs simply didn't hit the ball despite one of the strongest lineups in the league. Management, which had spent millions of dollars on such high-profile free agents as George Bell and Danny Jackson, lost patience with the veteran manager and felt firing him now might motivate the team. Zimmer was in his fourth season with the Cubs. He guided them to a division title in 1989, but they slumped to fourth place last year. Dugout coach Joe Altobelli will replace Zimmer, who won nearly 900 games as a major league manager. For National Public Radio, I'm George Hoffman in Chicago.
The launch of the space shuttle Columbia has been delayed because of a series of problems with faulty computer parts and fuel sensors. The shuttle was to have taken off tomorrow morning on a biomedical mission. NASA engineers stopped the countdown today after three problems surfaced within hours of one another. A space agency spokesman said it was decided to replace 9 fuel temperature sensors and 1 of 5 main computers. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Morris Dees, is a civil rights lawyer who helped virtually bankrupt two hate groups, the Klan and the White Aryan Resistance. In 1981, two members of the Klan lynched Michael Donald, a young black man, in Alabama. Instead of just going after these two men, Dees sued the Klan on behalf of the dead man's mother and won $7 million in damages. The decision set a precedent that a hate group could be held responsible for the violent actions of its members. Dees won a similar decision last year in a lawsuit against the White Aryan Resistance in Oregon. The court ordered this white supremacist group to pay $12.5 million in damages to the family of a black Ethiopian man who was murdered in Portland. Morris Dees is the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. He co-founded this nonprofit legal and educational center in 1971. In his new memoir, A Season for Justice, Dees describes his life as a civil rights lawyer in the South and his strategy for putting hate groups out of business.
The individuals are usually pawns of the leaders of these groups. Historically, when a Klansman was caught for, say, killing Goodman Swirney and Cheney down in Mississippi, or Violet Uzo in Alabama, or for blowing up the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham to kill the four little girls, it was only some rank-and-file, low-level member that was caught. So, and when we had the case to represent Michael Donald, the killers of Michael Donald, the black man who was lynched in 1981 in Mobile, I decided that it was time to go around these local small-time people and go after the top leaders of the particular Klan group involved. They're the United Klans of America. And we showed that the United Klans of America even has a public front of being a nonviolent group. We traced a history of violence to carry out its goal, and that was the God-given supremacy of the white race as stated in their Constitution. And so we said, look, a corporation is responsible for the acts of its agents. Why shouldn't a Klan group be responsible for the acts of its members? And so that was the basis of it.
What had the legal obstacles in the past been that stood in the way of holding hate groups responsible for the actions of its members?
Well, there actually have been no legal obstacles at all. I think it's just nobody had the idea to do it. They always went for the person with the smoking gun or the can of gasoline at the black church. Some of the obstacles that have been raised by, I think, misinformed people, say like in the ACLU, is that wait a minute, you can't go out to a group because you're going to violate their freedom of speech. And in all the cases that I've done, whether it's the most recent one against the White Aryan Resistance and its leader Tom Metzger for the acts of skinheads up in Portland for killing a black man, they always scream First Amendment. But when you get down to the bare facts, and if you have the right kind of investigation, which we detail in the book that I've just written, you'll see that in the case of the White Aryan Resistance, they actually sent a corporate vice president of the White Aryan Resistance to Portland, Oregon, for the purpose of organizing skinheads. And we were able to uncover documents that showed that they gave him material to pass out that encouraged bashing blacks over the heads with baseball bats. We had a piece of video footage that we had where Tom Metzger, the head of the group, encouraged skinheads to commit violence against minorities. And we had also some undercover photographs of Tom Metzger in the desert in Arizona training skinheads to shoot AK-47 Chinese assault rifles. So with that kind of evidence, the ACLU backs off because they see that this is not like you're trying to say that an anti-abortion group should be held liable if somebody goes and burns an abortion clinic. And just because some strong rhetoric by the anti-abortion group, it's quite different. Here we're talking about actual encouragement to commit violent acts, not simply just rhetoric.
Was it conspiracy charges you were using?
Yes, it was. That was one of the three claims that we made in both the case in Mobile, where we got a $7 million verdict against the United Klans of America, and the case recently in Oregon, where we got a judgment of $12 million against War, White Air and Resistance. We claimed that they conspired to injure minorities based because of the goals of the organization, and was carried out through their lower-level members.
Now, is the kind of prosecution that you've been doing dependent on having informants within the organization?
Not so much informants, because usually the lynching takes place, or the death, or the blowing up of a synagogue, or whatever, and then you get into the investigation of it. And we've been successful in getting high-level members of these organizations. For example, in War, we got Dave Mazzella, the National Vice President of Recruitment, to turn against his former leaders. A young man who meant well. He's just a young man who had been misguided and wanted something more out of life than the hate he'd been taught. I talked to him. I met with him. And he decided that he was going to tell what Tom Metzger had told him to do and had what he sent him to Oregon to do and what he did when he got to Oregon. This is, I think, essential to convince a jury that we aren't just out trying to go after these groups because of unpopular beliefs. In the case against the United Klans of America, for example, or the one up in North Carolina against the White Patriot Party, where they'd stolen some $50,000 worth of military supplies, hand grenades, C4 plastics, to supply to a neo-Nazi group called the White Patriot Party, we was able to get the actual person who bought and stole quite a few of this stuff from Fort Bragg and who actually got active duty United States military personnel to teach these people in the woods of North Carolina to come forward and testify.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Morris Dees. He's the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center and of Klan Watch. And there's a new memoir that's just been published called A Season for Justice, The Life and Times of Civil Rights Lawyer Morris Dees. In 1988, you won a decision against the Ku Klux Klan, and the jury found them responsible for $7 million in damage. That suit was said to have bankrupted the United Klans of America. But the Klan is still in business.
This particular Klan group, the United Klans of America, was the largest, most violent Klan group this country's had in, you know, many 50 years. That Klan group was bankrupted. Its national headquarters was sold and the property given to the mother of Michael Donald, a black woman, Ms. Beulah May Donald. There are other splinter Klan groups, usually existing even no more than a post office box and in the minds of five or six people. Five Klansmen will put on sheets, march down the street, and it looks like you have a Klan organization. You really don't. There is no real effective Klan organization in the country today. The United Klans was the most dangerous, violent group this country's had in 50 years, responsible for the deaths of probably 50 or 75 black people and whites during the Civil Rights Movement. That's the group that we went after and targeted and bankrupted.
And what's the difference between the United Klans of America and the Ku Klux Klan?
Well, Ku Klux Klan is just a term that represents Klan that was a group of white supremacists organized back right after the Civil War. There's groups called the Invisible Empire, Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. That's a group that we've gotten $1 million verdict against recently and put them out of business. There's a group called the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the White Knights of the Camellia Ku Klux Klan. And they've got about 50 or 75 sub-names. The United Klans of America, though, was a coalition of a number of Klan groups that came together during the Civil Rights Movement days and reaped havoc across the Southeast in bombings, church bombings, the things you saw in Mississippi burning.
Now, last year, you won a $12 million lawsuit against the White Aryan Resistance. What effect is that verdict having on their ability to carry on? Have they been bankrupted?
The property where the national headquarters is and on the property belonging to Tom Metzger, the owner of White Aryan Resistance, which, by the way, is a for-profit organization, and his followers were surprised to find that revelation we made in court. We are in the process of selling that property to satisfy this judgment and also have seized all of his equipment and personal property. You can't stop Tom Metzger from making talks or being on a Donahue show, which he was recently. But what we have stopped is his ability to pay for organizers to go out, organize skinheads, which was the territory of the white supremacy market he staked out. You can stop that because you don't have any money. All the money coming to his post office box where people are sending in contributions, dues, et cetera, has been seized by a court, and our collectors go down and get the money out of the box and give him the mail. So I think that effectively that organization will be eliminated. And in the process, we're collecting money for the 9-year-old son of Melagata Sarah, who was beaten to death. This child has no means of support, and his total support is going to come from the money that we get.
What kinds of precedents do you think that these suits against hate groups have set?
Well, I think they set a powerful precedent. First of all, from a legal standpoint, the theories we use can be used against any group that uses violence to carry out its means when it goes over the line of First Amendment-protected speech. Another precedent it sets, or at least a message it sends out, is to the rank-and-file members of these organizations. They see that it may cost them money. They may get hit in the pocketbook, and sometimes that's even more effective than putting them in jail.
Which are the hate groups now that you think really count, the ones that actually have some power left?
Well, quite frankly, none has any power as the Order or the Aryan Nations or the War or the Klan groups. I think they've all been thrown in disarray by our lawsuits and by the very effective action of the Justice Department in prosecutions. That's not to say that you don't have organized white supremacists and they're not carrying out their message, but as far as an effective group, they're gone. And a lot of it's happened, too, because there's been a change in attitude in the country. Today, unfortunately, though, there's a rising tide of racial violence in America, not so much sponsored by hate groups, but the kind of thing you saw in Bensonhurst, New York, where whites attacked black from coming into their neighborhood. In 1990, there were more hate crime murders in America than there was in 1964. In 1964, there was 18, and that was the highest number in any year in the civil rights movement time frame. And in 1964, all of those murders took place in the Deep South. In 1990, those 22 murders took place all over the United States, only two in the Deep South. So we have a totally different kind of problem. We have a backlash in this country today on race matters. We have a deeply divided racial gap between whites and blacks. We have demagogues on both sides. We have a president of the United States who uses a Willie Horton commercial showing a black man to create fear, and I think, in the minds of white voters. And then you have Jesse Jackson going to New York in the election before, calling New York Jaime Town. And you have people like Tawana Brawley's handlers who said, well, it doesn't matter that Tawana Brawley was really not raped. Blacks have been raped before, so what? You know what? But you can't build a movement on lies and truths and demagoguery. The message that Dr. King so poignantly got across in his movement was one of love and love and of understanding and of brotherhood and sisterhood. And that's what we've got to deal with today.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Morris Dees, and he's co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center and of the group Klan Watch. And he has a new memoir called A Season for Justice. This is Fresh Air. Civil rights lawyer Morris Dees is my guest. You were just making the point that hate groups aren't as powerful as they were, but there sure is a lot of hatred and hate crimes in the United States. It's just that it's more on an individual basis as opposed to an organized basis. So what kind of work do you see your group doing in the near future?
Well, when I tried the case of Michael Donnell, his mother inspired me through something she did in the courtroom to launch a national education program. She was sitting there faced with the Klansman that lynched her son. And I tell this story better, I guess, in the book than I can do it personally because I get a little emotional trying to tell it orally. And as the Klansman stood up overcome with emotion himself, and begged her forgiveness for the lynching of her son. In that little courtroom in Mobile, she looked at him and she said, "Son, I've already forgiven you." And I sat there and watched her. And Tommy, that wasn't a dry eye in the jury, on the bench, at the counsel table. And I sat there watching this black woman who lost the most precious thing in her life look at this man in the face, this white man who killed her son, and say that. And that was, to me, a higher justice than that court could ever render. It's a kind of love that we talk so much about but know so little of. And I tried to capture the spirit of that in my book, and I tried to point out how we needed to move forward with an educational program. I think we're moving from the classroom to the classroom from the courtroom, because I think that you can just do so much getting judgments against these people. You've got to change the hearts and minds of both black and white Americans.
You at one time learned that you were on a hit list from one of the hate groups, along with Alan Berg, who was actually murdered, and Norman Lear. In what ways have you been harassed and threatened because of your attacks against the hate groups?
Well, in 1983, the Southern Poverty Law Center was burned to the ground by a group of Klansmen. We caught the one that did it. He was on the Imperial Council of a group called the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. He got 15-year prison sentence for it. That was a direct result of us representing the Vietnamese fishermen in Galveston Bay against the Klan trying to run them out and burn their boats, etc. So after that, I've had a number of death threats. People have come on my property, and one of them stayed out there, was paid money to try to kill me. And fortunately, I've had a tremendous amount of help from the FBI. They have a team of people that work very closely with us and provide us a lot of information. We have our local security.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Morris Dees, who is the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center and of Klan Watch. He has a new memoir called A Season for Justice, The Life and Times of Civil Rights Lawyer Morris Dees. You've pioneered a lot in the way of civil rights litigation. You've also done a lot of pioneering in the work of direct mail for fundraising. Before you became a civil rights lawyer, you were a businessman, and you started a very successful business, which I think helped you become a millionaire. And you were basically using direct mail to sell books. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you learned about direct mail in business that you were able to apply to fundraising for the purposes of civil rights litigation?
Well,
and I should say that you started doing this before direct mail became really known as a technique of Tom Vigory and the right.
Right. Well, Richard Vigory and I.
I'm sorry, Richard Vigory. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Richard Vigory is, in fact, is a friend of mine, and I guess the thing that I used when I was McGovern's national finance director in 1972, we got 700,000 people to contribute $24 million to his campaign because he'd had no other way to raise his money to get the Democratic nomination then. It was the same things I used when I started my book club and direct mail book club and other things, and that is we weren't ashamed to sell. We presented McGovern in all of the details necessary for people to make a decision to sit down and write a check, not the simple one-page letter, but the more detailed explanation, because I would like to bring the reader of this mail that we send out as close to the counsel table as I'm sitting and put them in the chair next to me so they can understand and feel the pain and hurt of Mrs. Donnelly. She sits and has to listen to this, and the only way to do that sometimes is to maybe take a piece of transcript of her testimony and reproduce that and send it out to our supporters so they can see. And when our building was burned in 1983, I mean, it hurt me. I mean, I sat on the curb outside of my building and cried that this was happening to me. And in order for our donors to know what we felt, we had pictures taken of this immediately and got out to all of our donors. We didn't ask a penny in return. I just wanted them to feel what I felt and what our people felt, that what we was going through. This technique, as you want to call it, to me is just really good. You might call it sales, selling, or advertising, or whatever it might be. I don't in any way apologize for this. In fact, groups like the ACLU and Sierra Club and Cousteau Society, Greenpeace, Planned Parenthood, NARAL, Now, I've helped all of those groups over the years to go from the time when they would send their donors one contribution request a year and apologize for that. And I've sat down with the board of Planned Parenthood and said, look, your contributors want to fight Jesse Helms, who's trying to end the right to abortion. You've got to write these people every 3 or 4 weeks because that's how much you, that's why you, your money needs are great. You can't just write them once a year with an apologetic, you don't want to really give, do you?
Do you think there's any fundamental differences between the way the left and the right use direct mail?
I don't know. I don't raise money for the left or the right. And so I really don't know. There are extremists on both sides that, you know, that try to raise money by getting, by being shrill, or Richard Viguerie might raise money by trying to make it seem like your life will end if you don't get Teddy Kennedy out of there, and you don't, you know, have, if you don't abolish people trying to stop gun control, or if you don't fight for against abortion, et cetera. And on the left, we find people that that really, quite frankly, almost relish in the success of the Klan when they have a march because it focuses the issue. Some of these radical anti-Klan groups in the country are actually the Klan's best friend, because when the Klan goes out in the street, these people, they don't really feel the Klan has a First Amendment right to march, which I do. They'll go out in the street and break through police lines, and so you get more of them arrested than the Klan. Klan looks good by comparison to these kind of people. Their fundraising, though, I've seen, has not been very successful. I guess we probably reach a more middle-of-the-road group. We published an intelligence report that goes to 5,000 law enforcement agencies, worked very closely with the FBI, the Justice Department, and it brought them around to seeing the danger that's happening and brought them around to bringing lawsuits. They may surprise a lot of people, but the Reagan-Bush Justice Department filed more lawsuits against the Klan, put more Klansmen in the in jail than all prior Justice Departments put together.
Because you have successfully prosecuted hate groups, you've been the target of hate groups yourself. One of the ways that hate groups try to intimidate people like you probably is to threaten your family as well as yourself. Has that ever happened? And I'm wondering how you've wrestled with that. I mean, sometimes a lot of people who will feel perfectly fine being the target themselves will want to do everything in their power to protect their families. I'm sure you've had to wrestle with this. How do you deal with it?
My 14-year-old daughter was in our home when the Klan came on the property, or some white supremacists, and the guards put us in a little room, and it was quite a moving thing to see her sit there and tremble in fear. But she overcame it and looked at in that room that night and said to me, you know, after we've been there a while, that, Dad, you know, she said, I'm reading Anne Frank now in school, and she said, you know, this is nothing compared to what those children went through in Germany. And it really got to me. And that night after we went to bed, after the FBI left, she had put the Christmas tree angel over the top of my bed. And my family has really supported me. They hadn't run from this fight. And, you know, and I think that they'd probably would not want me to quit just simply because there's some danger.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry, for having me.
My guest has been Morris Dees, the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he has a new memoir called A Season for Justice, The Life and Times of Civil Rights Lawyer Morris Dees. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A freelance writer sitting in front of a word processor may seem far removed from a worker on an assembly line, but they soon may find themselves part of the same union. Coming up, a talk with Phil Wheeler of the United Auto Workers and Jonathan Tessini of the National Writers Union about a possible affiliation between the two unions. And TV critic David Bianculli doesn't know why Henry Kissinger gave the weather report on CBS This Morning, but David has some opinions on how Kissinger did. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The government of India has issued what it calls a red alert because of fear of more violence after the murder of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. The 46-year-old Gandhi was killed by a bomb planted in a flower pot as he campaigned in the southern part of the country. The bomb went off as Gandhi stepped from his car into a crowd of supporters and killed over a dozen other people. Since Sunday, election-linked violence has claimed about 200 lives. Stephen Coe, bureau chief in New Delhi for The Washington Post, says the death of Gandhi leaves Indian politics in a state of confusion.
It's too early to say exactly what the government's going to do, but it's probably safe to predict that the election that we were in the midst of this week and which was to be counted and decided early next week will be postponed. More broadly, Rajiv Gandhi's death erases a man who was at the center of this country's politics. He was heir to the family dynasty that has governed this country almost without interruption since independence. He was also a symbol, at least in his own party workers' minds, of centrism, secularism, and stability, three ideas that are being challenged in India at the moment anyway by a rise in religious feeling and rioting, separatist movements. His death really couldn't have come at a more difficult time.
Stephen Cole of The Washington Post. In Washington, the Bush administration has welcomed the resignation of President Mengistu of Ethiopia and is hopeful that the transfer of power to the vice president of that country will help bring peace. George Gatta reports from the State Department.
Mengistu's forces had been having increasing difficulty in containing three rebel groups, all of which had been demanding his ouster. The State Department called for an immediate end to all military operations in Ethiopia in order to allow a political dialogue to begin. U.S.-sponsored peace talks set for next week in London are expected to go ahead as planned. Among all Africa's leaders, Mengistu was perhaps the most disliked by U.S. officials. Former Assistant Secretary of State Chester Crocker called Mengistu a thug who killed his way into power. He said Mengistu's policies aggravated the famine conditions in Ethiopia, and as Crocker sees it, Mengistu's departure augurs well for next week's peace talks. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Denmark's National Bank has announced a cut in its two main interest rates, citing what it called low inflation and stable international interest conditions. The bank says its lending rate will be cut to 9.5%, and the bank deposit rate will be cut to 9%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 14 points to close at 2,906.08 in active trading. This is NPR News. U.S. officials in Washington say that an American warship came under fire from two small boats in the Persian Gulf earlier today and chased them off with gunfire. The Defense Department says the USS LaSalle reported being fired upon this morning about 1:25 Eastern Standard Time. According to officials, the U.S. ship suffered no casualties and no damage, and the two boats headed north at high speed. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Energy Committee continues to work on comprehensive energy legislation, but has postponed a vote to decide whether to open a wilderness area in Alaska for oil exploration and drilling. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more on the story.
Louisiana Democrat Bennett Johnston, the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee and an advocate of oil drilling in Alaska, stalled the vote today. Johnston says he plans to try again to reach agreement on how best to require the automobile industry to make more fuel-efficient cars. His hope is that fuel efficiency requirements will be a sweetener in the energy package that will win the support of members who oppose a bill that relies heavily on increased oil production. Johnston said today fuel efficiency requirements will greatly enhance the chances of passing a measure on the floor of the Senate that will allow exploration and drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Meanwhile, in the House, Interior Committee Chairman George Miller says no matter how loaded up the legislation is with energy conservation measures, it doesn't justify opening up the refuge. If all that oil is saved, Miller says, there's even less of a need to drill. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
NASA officials have delayed the launch of the Space Shuttle Columbia until late next week because of a number of last-minute problems. Liftoff had been scheduled for early tomorrow morning for a 9-day research mission involving 7 astronauts. Workers will now replace all 9 fuel temperature sensors. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One big established union and one young small union may soon come together in what might strike some as a surprising affiliation. The National Writers Union was founded in 1983 and now represents about 3,000 freelance writers, including book authors, poets, journalists, and technical writers, people who don't work in traditional shop or office situations. The National Writers Union will soon vote on whether to affiliate with the United Auto Workers of America. Economic problems within the auto industry have pushed the UAW toward greater diversification. We invited Jonathan Tessini, the head of the National Writers Union, and Phil Wheeler of the UAW, to talk with us about this proposed affiliation and what it has to say about their individual unions and the direction of the labor movement. Why is the Writers Union considering such an affiliation?
About 2 years ago, we began to realize that for two reasons it would be worth exploring an affiliation with a union, a larger union. And the two reasons are, one, resources. We were growing very, very fast, but we reached a point where our resources that we were getting in terms of dues were very small for us to help us grow further. We are basically a volunteer organization, and we realized that if we wanted to grow beyond our 3,000 members, we really needed an influx of resources, and it was clear that a larger union would be able to afford us that. But more importantly, the people who initiated the explorations with other unions in the Writers Union also believed philosophically that it was important for us to be part of the larger labor movement for a number of reasons. One is that we believe that labor, with all its problems, and let's face it, labor, it does have problems now, is the main place that workers in America today can fight for justice in the workplace. And that may sound like a cliche, but the reality is today that workers are in probably a similar situation that they found themselves in the 20s and 30s, where you have workplaces that are much more unsafe, wages are declining, and corporate America has unleashed in the last 10 and 15 years a very strong assault on working people's standard of living and their power in the workplace.
Can you give me a sense of some of the rights you'd like to see writers have that they don't really have now?
There's such a broad range, and I'll just give you a few. For instance, I think the idea of kill fees, which magazine writers and newspaper writers are liable or have to work under, are outrageous. What a kill fee is essentially a percentage of the fee that you are guaranteed to get that you are paid if the publication decides not to pay you. Now, if you look anywhere in the world in terms of things like architecture or other crafts like that, like writing, something artistic, there's no such thing as a kill fee. You cannot use the person again, or you can decide that maybe you don't want to publish it when you own the publishing press. That's always your right and power. But a person should be paid in full if they complete the terms of the contract and the assignment. That's one thing. Rates, clearly money is an issue. Writers are paid terrible wages. They are paid oftentimes less than minimum wage. That's an outrage. In the book industry, you have a situation where a publishing house can reject a manuscript and then try to get the advance back for reasons that have nothing to do with the manuscript. You know, there's a lot of musical chairs that goes on in the publishing industry. Sometimes an editor leaves a publishing house, and a writer who's got a minuscule advance, and I consider minuscule even around $20,000-$25,000 that someone has to, that's all they have for a year to live on, the publishing house cancels the book and then demands the money back. That's an outrage, and that's got to stop.
Phil Wheeler of the United Auto Workers. I know the UAW has been looking to organize for several years now new workers and bringing new kinds of workers into the UAW, clerical workers, other white-collar workers. Are those new frontiers already old frontiers? Do you feel like you've already exhausted some of what was just a few years ago the new frontiers in the labor movement?
Well, they're not really new frontiers for us. We've been out there doing that for quite some time. We've just recently, with District 65, one of our affiliates, organized the teachers' assistants and research assistants up in the University of Massachusetts. 2 weeks ago, we organized city workers up in Nashua, New Hampshire. A few months back, we organized state workers out in Indiana, half of the state, about 16,000 workers there. And we have all the state workers in Michigan. District 65, who is affiliated with the UAW, have Boston University, the clerical workers there, legal aides, legal assistants, and legal and attorneys across the country are part of 65. So we've been doing this for some time, and we're going to continue to do it. There's still a lot of unorganized workers, as you know. Most of the country is unorganized. When people need a union, they go to one that they think will help them. And you don't look at a union anymore as the auto workers, as an example. We basically refer to ourselves now as the union of all workers.
UAW, Union of All Workers, right. Is that you think that's going to become an official title change?
I don't think it'll be an official title change, but it's certainly one that we use more frequently because we really are. We do represent just about every kind of worker you can think of.
Phil Wheeler, do you have to sell this to your members, you know, having the National Writers Union join the UAW?
No. Our membership looks to having all sorts of workers. I think it helps them. The more people that we have involved in the labor movement, more people helping us deal with issues that affect us as workers is helpful. And so it's to our benefit. And I think also, you know, you're talking about writers here. The writers can contribute a lot. The labor's message is tough to get out nowadays. We're censored quite a bit. And hopefully the writers can help in that area.
Jonathan, is that on your agenda too?
Well, you're asking the wrong person because I happen to write about labor for a living, so it's always on my personal agenda. But I think Phil's point is well taken. You know, writers in the past, in the 20s and 30s, contributed a lot to labor movement, not only in writing, sort of for the general media, but creating poems about what labor was doing, and just being involved in the culture of labor, which I think labor has lost substantially in the last 10, 20 years. We hope to add to that. I wanted to add, if I might, 2 points. I think that you were in some way asking the question, how would writers see themselves in the UAW? How do they feel connected to that? And I think we answered that a little bit about culturally. But I also think that writers increasingly are realizing that the industries they're dealing with are no longer the mom and pop kind of newspaper. They're not these little small newspapers around the country. They're not magazines that are held by a small group. We are facing international conglomerates. There's an estimate that by the beginning of the next century, which is just actually less than 10 years away, there will be a dozen entertainment companies around the world that will control everything from television to theme parks to writing to publishing to books, journals, everything. And in order to have the kind of power and the ability to organize and fight against these people, we need to have links to the labor movement, not just in this country, but around the world.
An individual is even weaker when confronting a global corporation than they are when confronting small management.
That's correct. I mean, think about confronting the Rupert Murdochs, the Robert Maxwells of the world. They have, right now, a lot more resources, probably will always have more resources, but their power is incredible and growing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the possible affiliation of the National Writers Union with United Auto Workers, and joining me is Jonathan Tessini, who's the president of the National Writers Union, and Phil Wheeler, who's the director of Region 9A of the United Auto Workers. He's based in Hartford. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the proposed affiliation between the National Writers Union and the United Auto Workers, and my guests are Jonathan Tessini of the National Writers Union and Phil Wheeler of the UAW. Is this a bad time for labor unions in terms of the PR labor unions have been getting? Do you find that there's more resistance against unions than there's been in the past few decades?
Over the past decade, it's probably been highlighted a little bit more, but I don't know if we've ever gotten a fair shake. I can't recall any us ever getting a fair shake with the media and in general. I think if you look at the labor coverage of anything we do, it's typically the problem areas where there might be a problem that gets the constant coverage. When we have when we've done something great, if you hear it at all, it's a 20-second shot and it's over with. And so people, the general public, sees it in a bad light. And it's just, I don't think it's ever been fair, ever. And I've been involved in the labor movement for 25 years. So, anything we do in that area to try to change it is got to be an improvement.
Last year, I did a study for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which looked at labor coverage, and it has gotten worse in the last few years. There are virtually no labor reporters in the country. People who generally cover labor come from the business desk. They're generally white men, middle to upper class, and they have no sense of what labor is about. And Phil's right. They just write about the corruption that is sort of highlighted, the problem areas. You looked at it, you could see in the Eastern strike, for instance, I remember very clearly that when ABC, during ABC's coverage of the Eastern strike, when they anointed the person of the week, they didn't pick any of the thousands of workers who fought to save their jobs or worked in their communities. They picked Peter Uberoth, the golden corporate boy who tried to buy Eastern Airlines and failed. So I think that was sort of a symbol. It also relates to the kind of issues that we have to deal with in the writers' union in terms of who the enemy is. Who owns the media today? They're big corporations. More than ever before, it's concentrated. General Electric owns NBC. ABC is owned by Capital Cities, and you can go down the line. And, you know, it's not a mistake that the word that filters down from above is the workers are not important.
How might an affiliation with a larger union give you more clout in the battles that you're trying to win within the publishing industry?
Two basic ways. The affiliation will give us resources in order to build our locals stronger. We have locals all across the country, and the locals are our important nucleuses. And secondly, as I mentioned before, remember, our employers are no longer the people just in the city around the block. They span globes, span oceans and continents. They're all around the world. And linking into the labor movement, both nationally and internationally, will give us more power. There was a very good example just now. We have a campaign that is very, very successful, has been so far, against the book publishing industry. We're going to be demonstrating at the American Booksellers Association meeting on June 1st. And we got support from the International Federation of Journalists. We would not necessarily have had that link had we not already been involved in the labor movement and in the international labor movement in terms of contacts and mutual work.
I mean, can I add, Terry, to that just a little?
Sure,
too? I think you also, when and if these problems come up with the publishers, et cetera, that another thing that being part of the mainstream of labor, we have our national boycotts that, as a last resort type thing, that can be very helpful in dealing with some of the problems that the writers are faced with. And so that we can, if gets to the point need be, we can impose a national boycott on a particular publisher or whatever to solve some of these problems.
I believe strongly in a concept that the labor movement has begun to explore, albeit in small circles, known as corporate campaign, which basically is the idea that you attack a corporation in every aspect of its life, and I use life very loosely because, you know, corporation doesn't have, it's not a living being, but it, you go after the shareholders, you go after the bank connections, you go to the public and bring your case, which Phil was talking about in terms of a boycott. It's a comprehensive campaign, and I think increasingly unions like ours that have to face international, multinational corporations need to rely and on that kind of tactic, and that will be very possible and will be possible to execute if we have links to the labor movement.
Jonathan, do you think you're going to have a hard time selling this affiliation to your members?
I knew you were going to ask that question eventually. I would say that the affiliation will pass. If I wouldn't bet on what the percentage would be. We set up a very, we didn't want this to be a controversial decision where it would pass 51% to 49% and divide the union. So we set up a higher threshold of 60%. Has to pass the delegates by 60% and the rank and file by 60%. My feeling is that it is going to pass, and I think by a good margin, because I think when people look at what we want to do, where we want to go with the union, how we need to grow, and really it's frankly a self-interested decision. People want power, and I think we will have a good argument that this will give us more power and give us the ability to grow. Now, if I was to just the union, the executive board, the delegates, if we were to drop it out there in the membership and say, okay, vote on it, it might not pass, because I think people don't know from just paper that you send really what it's about and have a lot of questions. So my intention, along with other people in the union, is to call the membership and talk to every single member.
What kind of resistance are you expecting from the people who aren't immediately for it?
Well, I think that falls into a few categories. One is, you know, what do writers have to do with auto workers? And I think we've talked a little bit about that. And I think there's good answer. I think that we are workers and we have mutual interests with auto workers. Secondly, I think there's always a fear when you've been an independent union to joining another organization that's bigger than you. And that's a legitimate concern. I don't think there are going to be problems. I think that it will be a really good relationship, but I think the membership out there in general wants to know what that's going to mean. So I think that's going to be an issue we're going to have to address.
Jonathan Tessini is the president of the National Writers Union. Phil Wheeler is the director of Region 9A of the UAW based in Hartford. The Writers Union delegates vote on the affiliation in June. If it passes, the membership will vote in August. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, how are you covering the assassination today of former Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi?
We'll be hearing, Terry, from journalists in India about what happened at the campaign stop in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu, where the former Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi was killed by a bomb blast. We'll also be hearing what his death is likely to mean for his party and for the elections now underway and for the future of Indian politics. Also, a discussion of the resignation and flight of Mengistu Haile Mariam, the Ethiopian leader, and a talk with Clark Clifford about 50 years of advising presidents of the United States.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. On morning network TV news shows, the weatherman is usually an affable, upbeat kind of guy. But not this morning on CBS This Morning. Our TV critic David Bianculli was tuned in when hosts Harry Smith and Paula Zahn prepared their viewers.
And of course, if you're tuning in this morning and expecting to get the weather from Mark McEwen, you'll get that.
And a Nobel Peace Prize winner, Dr. Henry Kissinger, this morning. He's going to go solo in this half hour.
Is that
okay? A first time alone at the weather map.
Roll the VCRs.
I remember 2 years ago when Ronald Reagan did an inning of color commentary during baseball's All-Star game. That took care of sports. Now Henry Kissinger is doing the weather. All we have to do is get Dan Quayle to step into Ted Baxter's shoes, and we've got an all-politics team for some local TV newscast. I'm a TV critic, not a psychologist, so I won't spend time wondering why such powerful men have such weak fantasies. It is odd, though, that these people who are on TV all the time anyway still have dreams of TV stardom. Instead, I'll limit myself to Kissinger's performance as a guest weatherman. The real weatherman, Mark McEwen, was always close by, either chuckling or heckling. And a lot of heckling was called for.
Don't go far away.
I won't.
If you live anywhere between Egypt, Pennsylvania, and Lebanon, New Hampshire, I foresee more peaceful weather for you.
No, it didn't get any better. In fact, during the next report, in which Kissinger predicted sun, lots of sun, for the Middle East, he got thrown off trying to make the right hand movements while watching his image in the studio TV monitor. I guess it's kind of like clipping nose hairs while looking in the mirror. Not as easy as it looks.
The temperatures will continue to climb. Today, I'm predicting 80-degree temperatures near the Mediterranean Sea. I'm pointing the wrong way, but... The Mediterranean
Sea. Just point to your right, sir. I think you know about pointing to the right. There we go.
Kissinger handled his chores like a good sport and asked to come back. As a joke, McEwen offered him $20 to stay away. Hey, if it'll help, I'll throw in an extra $10. Anything to stop politicians from embarrassing themselves as sportscasters or weathercasters. Let them embarrass themselves in politics, where they belong. There was one wonderful reward for watching today's This Morning, though. CBS anchor Charles Osgood changed gears, too, and he became a singer, providing new lyrics and his own piano accompaniment to a familiar tune. It's such a winning performance, he ought to start dreaming of a whole new career. Politics, maybe?
I wonder who's Kissinger now. I never imagined somehow that this man who opened Red China's wall, as you recall, he's done it all, would dream that one day he might be a weatherman on the TV. We'll know before long if his forecast is wrong. I wonder who's Kissinger now.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. I'm Terry Gross.
I wonder if future reports will have Mother Teresa on sports. I wonder if she is a Mets fan like me. I wonder who's Kissinger now.
Bravo!
Bravo, bravo.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The deregulation of the phone company and the availability of new technology has allowed us to make lots of choices between phone companies and phone equipment. But being a good consumer can be a confusing and time-consuming business. On the next Fresh Air, we get some help from the author of a new Consumer Reports guide. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.